I call this Committee of Economic Development to order. Good morning, everyone. Can I have someone move the minutes from March 27?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Liar.
Rep. Liar?
All right. Ryer. I'm sorry. Rep. Ryer. Rep. Ryer moves the minutes of the approval of minutes from March 27. Any discussion on the minutes? All those in favor of adopting the minutes? It's going to take me a minute to just get into my role here.
Good morning.
All those in favor
of... You want some coffee?
I can't drink coffee. Come on now. All those in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have a full agenda today, so we're going to be trying to keep time and make sure that everyone stays within the time limits. Our first agenda item is presentation from the Women's Foundation, and that will take us about 30 minutes. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourselves and proceed with your presentation.
Good morning, everyone. For the record, my name is Janet Jimenez. I'm the Dr. Aretha Clark King Fellow at the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Hassan, for the opportunity to present the Status of Women and Girls of Minnesota report today. For 40 years, the Women's Foundation has invested more than $49 million in organizations across the state. Seeing and hearing from our community about the realities that women and girls face and advancing policies that advocate for them, I'm here today with Dr. Christina Ewig, who leads this research, which is the most comprehensive report of its kind in the state. We share this data with you as you consider important policies and funding choices this session and in the future to benefit Minnesotans. We know from the data and from listening to women and girls across Minnesota that if we improve economic security and safety for women, we can fulfill our state's promise and ensure that our renowned quality of life is experienced by all of our families. Women in our state are critical to economic growth and comprehensiveness and are essential contributors to families, communities, and the workforce. Yet, while some women and girls are thriving, too many are not safe and do not have access to economic opportunity because of barriers they face, often because of their gender, race, ethnicity, geography, ability, and sexuality. This research is unique that it looks at traditional race and ethnic categories, but other kinds of backgrounds, like the experience of women in greater and rural Minnesota, and how these attributes affect their experiences with access and opportunities. Whenever possible, the research also looks at major immigrant groups in our state. We know this research is not an end in itself. It helps inform and the investments we make from grant making to policy, and it's jumping off points to listen and invest in communities directly impacted by the disparities we see in the data, which is why we came here before you today. We know that this committee knows the power you have to make a difference in the lives of women and families, as well as we'll see when the paid and family medical leave takes into effect. As we highlight at the end of our presentation, this report is really meant to be a tool for action, so elected officials and decision makers across sectors can use their influence to address inequalities in their fields, instead of placing the burden of women on the women and communities most impacted. This is why the Women's Foundation funds solutions that target the root cause of the disparities we see in the report. Today, we're going to focus on research in economics and leadership that informs the work of this committee. Because Minnesota women are second in the nation in women's workforce participation, and in many cases are the heads of their households, we know Their economic success is directly tied to the well-being of children and families. We know the economic securities intersects with every other issue in the woman's life, impacting her health, safety, and access to leadership opportunities. So it's crucial that we invest in creating opportunities that sustain women's lives as caregivers for families and communities. To talk more about the economic building blocks that matter to women and families, I'll hand it over to Dr. Iwe.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Hassan. For the record, my name is Christina Ewig. I'm professor at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs, where I also direct the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy. Thank you, Chair Hassan and committee members, for this opportunity to share our latest research. Our latest research shows that women in Minnesota continue to be leaders in women's workforce participation. And women in the state earn the majority of all post-secondary degrees, but these achievements have not translated into economic security. So I'm going to focus this presentation on the gender wage gap, because wages are a key building block to economic security. This graph that you have here shows the average wages of women and men in Minnesota disaggregated by race and ethnicity. Women as a whole in the state earn 81 cents for every dollar earned by white men. White women make just a little bit over this average at 82 cents. Asian women, 72. Native American, 64 cents. Black women, 62 cents. And Latino women, for them, it's even lower at 57 cents compared to a dollar earned by every white male. And let's be cognizant, even within these categories, there's significant variation. So, for example, members of the state's refugee communities tend to earn less. Hmong women earn even less than Latinas at 55 cents compared to that male white dollar, and Somali women just 41 cents. All right, so that's a lot of numbers. Let's be clear about what that means. If we take the Latina woman that's taking home about 57 cents compared to the dollar taken home by a man, that's 40% less in income for the same hours worked by a white male. But does she get a coupon for 40% off the bread that she buys at the store each week? No. Does she get a discount of 40% off of her rent? No. She pays the same as everyone else does, market rates for the food that she buys for her family and the shelter that she puts over their heads. It means perhaps buying less that week in food. It means maybe living with other family members rather than having housing of her own with her nuclear family. It may mean that her kids don't get a birthday present that week or that year. And it's likely that there's less money for long-term investments for things like post-secondary education. The most disturbing aspect is that this gender wage gap is very resistant to change. We publish this status report on women and girls in Minnesota every 2 years. My center also publishes a report you may want to look at called Who Earns? That's a short fact sheet on the wage gap. And the numbers have barely budged. If we look at the year 2014, which is when the Women's Economic Security Act was passed, 10 years ago, women overall earned 79 cents on the dollar compared to men, and with very similar racial and ethnic disparities as what I've just reported to you today. So we've seen very minimal movement in the gender wage gap. And this adds up over time. You can see at the top of this slide that women overall in the state lose $483,000 in earnings over a lifetime compared to men. If we look at black women, Latina women, indigenous women, we're looking at losing about $1 million over a lifetime. So we know that Minnesota has the third largest racial wealth gap in the country. But there's also a significant gender wealth gap. And that, as I've just said in these numbers, you can tell intersects with race. On average, in the United States, here's the statistic rather than Minnesota, but on average in the U.S., women, in terms of wealth is your combination of your savings accounts, your home ownership, your cars. Women on average in the U.S. have about 55 cents in wealth compared to the dollar held by men. That wealth statistic is a little higher if we looked at white women, and it's a lot lower if we look at Black, Indigenous, Asian, and Latina women in the U.S. So this lifetime earning statistic, this $483,000 that's lost over a lifetime, tells us a bit about how that wealth gap develops over time, right? Because you're losing that money. You can't put it into your savings account. You can't put it into a home. What might a woman have invested with $480,000 in a lifetime? Of course, you're not going to get that all at once, but perhaps it would mean buying a car to get your kids more easily to school in the morning. Maybe it would mean a down payment on a starter home. Maybe it would mean investing in a child's post-secondary education. These are the kinds of investments that lead not just to economic security in the moment, but economic security for future generations. So our research also shows, for example, that single mothers in Minnesota, especially Black, Latina, and Native American moms, have much lower home ownership rates than married couple families or single moms of other races and ethnicities. And a number of factors lead to this wage gap that I've been talking about. The biggest driver is something we call occupational segregation. That's when women are concentrated in lower wage jobs and men are concentrated in higher wage jobs. More women in Minnesota are, as I have on the slide here, in minimum wage jobs, 56% overall. And if we look at greater Minnesota compared to the metro area, that gap is even a little bit bigger, with 58% of women in greater Minnesota holding minimum wage or less jobs. If we look at the service sector, which is dominated especially by Black, Indigenous, and Latina women, almost 30% of those women work in the service sector where there tend to be lower benefits or benefits are scarce. Let's look a little bit more carefully at occupational segregation. In male-dominated fields, at the top of this graph, where if we take the top end of that graph, the average wage is about $24 an hour. How we're defining that is those occupations in which 75% or more of that occupational group is male. That averages out to about $24 an hour. And we can see that at the very top, women make up just 3% of the construction trades, the highest paid. But they make up 83% of healthcare support workers that are at the bottom of that graph. And that is where we see an average wage of about $20 an hour when we take those same kinds of occupations with 75% female. So this is not a gap that's about skill. It's not a gap that's about education. For example, in Minnesota, we pay child care providers, which is a 94% female workforce, most of whom who have some college education. They earn an average of $14 an hour. Whereas we pay janitors in Minnesota, a 61% male workforce that generally, on average, lacks any higher education, an average wage of $17 an hour. Okay, so $3 an hour more. The message that sends, that disparity of who we're paying, even though it isn't contingent on skill or education, is that we don't value work that's predominantly carried out by women, even when it requires more education and skill. Thinking about STEM, I know this committee is probably interested in science, technology, engineering, and math. In this year's report, we broke down and thought about the fact that healthcare is actually a STEM field, but it's not usually considered in our traditional numbers in relationship to STEM. The traditional way of defining STEM is life and physical science, engineering, and math. If we take that narrow definition, the workforce is only 26% women and 74% men. If we add health, but now keep in mind health has a really wide range of occupations from surgeons to personal care assistants, which are paid much less, then we see 51% women and 49% men. This slide shows you how that participation in the STEM workforce, depending upon including health or not, breaks down across race and ethnicity. We see that white, Black, Native American, and Latina women are all underrepresented in that narrow definition of STEM, but even some groups are underrepresented in health occupations, such as Latinas and, to a lesser degree, Native American women. So I mentioned that the second, well, maybe I didn't mention, let me mention that the second biggest driver, next to occupational segregation, of that gender wage gap is discrimination. Sometimes discrimination is hard to distinguish from occupational segregation. For example, women, many women often try to work in male-dominated fields, but then they might find the climate to be hostile and they decide to move out. That's a combination of occupational segregation and discrimination going on at the same time. Other times we can see that discrimination happening quite clearly, where a woman and a man are in the exact same kind of job with the same degree of experience and same degree of education, yet there's a disparity in their wages. Still other times, discrimination happens in what we have come to understand as the glass ceiling, right, where women are less likely to move up in their workplace into leadership positions, which in turn are higher paid. So if we have here on the slide a statistic for you of only 9 of the top 78 publicly held companies in Minnesota are led by women. And if we even look at the nonprofit sector, in which the workforce is dominated by women, the leadership is just 37% women. That deficit impacts wages, as I mentioned, but that leadership deficit also means that we don't have the voices at the table, those experiences at the table that offer alternative solutions, because based upon all of our life experiences, we have different ideas of ways in which to solve the problems that we face as a society. We also know that it's very well documented that in state and national legislatures, having women at the table means different priorities come to the table. For example, we know that women legislators are more likely than male legislators to prioritize policies like health care and child care, probably because they've been so had so much experience directly in those areas, whether in the workforce or in the home. So I've talked about occupational segregation. I've talked about discrimination. I'd be remiss to not talk about care. Care responsibilities, whether it's for children, whether it's for elders, whether it's for those with disabilities, often keep women out of the workforce or lead them to work fewer hours. So that means less earnings. And that's tied with that wage gap. 94% of Minnesota families have insufficient income to meet the federal recommendation of spending no more than 7% of their household income on the cost of childcare. In this slide, you have these horizontal bars that show the percent of that group's median income, and they're divided by married and single women-headed households and by racial and ethnic group, how much of their income they must pay for center-based quality child care in Minnesota. Here we can see that even white married couples in Minnesota spend an average of 17%, not 7, 17% of their income on child care. While a Native American single mother, the cost of child care actually surpasses her average income. So it's just not an option. Minnesota ranks 10th in the country for the cost of quality center-based infant child care. So we've talked about infant care, now I'm narrowing it a little bit more. That cost is $17,441 a year for infant-based center-based child care. I work at the University of Minnesota. Tuition and fees at the University of Minnesota clock in at $16,598 a year. So it costs more to put an infant in child care than it costs to pay for tuition and fees for your college student, but your infant can't work a second job, can't get student loans, right? This is a burden on families. And there's not enough child care. There's an average of 2 children for every child care slot in the state, and we've seen this deficit exacerbated in recent years, especially in central Minnesota, where we've seen child care centers close. So if we want women and all the experience and all the insights that they bring in the workforce, quality child care is key infrastructure to get them there. And to deal with the wage gap, you have to address occupational segregation and discrimination and build that infrastructure so that they aren't taking excessive time out for care. Let's start with some solutions, or shift to some potential solutions. There is a legislative proposal currently on pay transparency. I would call that solution to be a front-end solution. It's simply about putting salary ranges up front in job descriptions. A number of countries have implemented what I would call a back-end solution after folks are hired, of mandating that employers publish their salaries and the ranges and how they compare between women and men. Pay transparency, whether front end or back end, gives employees more tools to be able to advocate for themselves, to know what range to ask for, and also to be able to compare their salaries to others. It also leads employers to be a little bit more careful about how they are balancing equity within their organizations if they know that that pay is going to be published in the case of a back-end version. Of course, implementing existing anti-discrimination laws is a really important way to also address that discrimination piece of the gender wage gap. Having pay transparency laws, especially the back-end type, helps for that to happen because you're more aware of the existence of discrepancies. When it comes to occupational segregation, because women are concentrated in low-wage work, one possibility is raising the minimum wage. That was done under WESA and could be done again at the state level. And another approach is to have programs that was also done under the Women's Economic Security Act that encourage women to enter those high-paying male-dominated jobs. I would love to see an evaluation of how well that's worked in the state. We know the numbers that have gone through that. We don't know the numbers of women that have stayed in those occupations after training or apprenticeships. The flip side of that occupational segregation equation is also valuing that women-dominated work that tends to be caring work, that tends to be lower paid. One way to potentially do that would be to extend the already existing equal pay certificate that we have in the state to smaller companies. Now it's just for larger companies, and potentially use it as a marketing tool, as a way that companies could advertise just how equitable they are by obtaining that certificate. And finally, we need care infrastructure to get families to work. As Janet mentioned, the passage of the paid family leave bill last year, I expect that to have some really important consequences, because we know from research elsewhere that that really does help increase workforce participation, especially of women. We'll see here how that plays out over time. That's part of that infrastructure. Another part is strengthening our child care and elder care infrastructure in the state through business incentives to provide more of that kind of support. And all of this is connected, right? Higher wages allow individuals to pay for higher quality care. And while I've been focusing on wages, let me end by saying that it's all connected. So if we want to address the wealth gap, wages are one component. But those higher wages allow one to purchase housing, which can be another piece of closing that wealth gap. And over time, getting beyond just wages to earning, to having wealth, that leads to the long-term security and to investment in the next generation. So thanks for your attention. I am very happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Ewick. You actually ended 6 minutes earlier than time, so that's wonderful. Thank you very much. This is very, important and very informative presentation. I can't say I'm surprised, because this is something that we all know. This is something that we have been talking about. And a lot of times I like to say I'm tired of talking about disparities. I want to talk about solutions. So the fact that you brought, hey, here's a problem, but here's also proposal for solutions. That's wonderful. We'll take a few questions, and then, like I said earlier, we have a full agenda. I encourage people to reach out to the Women's Foundation for follow-up questions, but we'll take maybe 2-3 questions. Lead Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to the testifiers. Appreciate the sharing the data and bringing the issue forward. As a father of two young daughters, this is something that I, you know, am very concerned for their future and want the best for them. So thank you for the data. I'm wondering if my understanding is correct, that there's a higher post-secondary enrollment among women over men. And I wonder what your thoughts are, how that projects for the future earning potential for young women. And then my second question, I'll just throw it out there at the same time, is do you have data that suggests second generation immigrants, women, do better economically and contribute more than first generation?
Dr. Iwick.
Chair Hassan, Representative, thank you for the question. With regard to education, we no longer see that as an element in the gender wage gap as a reason for it, just precisely for the reason that you mentioned, that, that women have caught up and now exceed men in terms of post-secondary education in particular. What's been a bit troubling is that while that has, that did help to close the wage gap in the 1980s, we have then seen a plateau. And so we still see disparities even when women have higher education compared to men in specific jobs. And part of that is the other elements that are going into it. It may be less hours due to care work. It may be discrimination. That's part of it. It may be experience is another piece in the sense that women are more likely to take time out of work, say to work part-time or to not work when a child is born in particular or when an elder needs care. And then that's missed opportunity for lifetime earnings but also for moving up in the pay scale. In terms of the question on second-generation immigrants, that's a really great question that I don't have an answer to. But in fact would like that answer and may look into that in our next research to see if the data would allow us to look at that difference.
You have a follow-up, Lead Professor?
No, I appreciate the answer, and data that I've seen does support that second generation immigrants actually even do better than the majority population. So maybe, you know, I hope in the future we'll see stronger numbers that are more equitable. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Casista Wutun.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here and speaking about this critical topic today. You spoke a lot about childcare, which is one of the areas I focus on in my work here at the legislature, and so I really appreciate you flagging that it's more expensive to send an infant to a childcare center than it is to send an 18-year-old to a year of college at the university. I think that when we look at the childcare industry, which you also mentioned, is about 94% staffed by women, female entrepreneurs who are owning their own businesses and stepping into their own and contributing to our economy in that way. When we consider policies that make it easier for people to pay what a living wage is, what, you know, what that service is worth, these people are helping raise our next generation. And it's one of the most important jobs that there is. But right now, the math doesn't math because parents can't afford to pay more. And providers look at a $14 an hour wage and think, I can earn more at a fast food job. I can earn more being a janitor. And it's not to discount the importance of those other jobs, but we need to really seriously look at how that impacts, number one, the parents, and again, mostly women who choose or not choose, have to stay home with their child if they're not able to earn enough in a salary to balance out the cost of care, but then also further supporting our economy in terms of the people who are serving in those jobs. And it's so circular. And I think, you know, we've made a lot of strides. I also think about the things that women pay for that men don't have to pay for. I look at Representative Feist's bill for menstrual equity in our public schools and across the state. I mean, I think that that's going to make a big difference. Not everybody has that extra bit of income to ensure that they have the products, the health care products that they need. So I think that that's really important. And then when you talk about financial education and how women don't know or don't maybe seem to know how to invest or just how to have that extra income to invest and purchase a home and some of those things. So even Chair Hassan's bill on financial education requirements in our high schools. I think that all of those steps are in the right direction. And I just really loved looking through this report and seeing all of these wins and these steps that we've made in the right direction. But it's not gone far enough yet. So I'm really excited to see again the impact of paid family medical leave going into effect here soon. And I also, we talk a lot about unintended consequences at the legislature, but when you said it's going to have some very important consequences, these are intended consequences. And I can't understate that PFML has been shown to make a tremendous impact on women in the workforce particularly, but on the economy as a whole. So thank you for the work that you do and for elevating these statistics and this data for us.
Thank you, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to both of you for your testimony. When I looked at the number women lose, 483,000 and change over their lifetime, and what they could spend on it, the thing that came to my mind was to have the means and the savings for a dignified old age. And we know that the number of elderly women in poverty continues to grow, and as the baby boom ages, that could be us, and at increasing rate will be us. It also has an impact on the families because, again, it's the women, it's the daughters, it's the nieces, the daughters-in-law who are taking care of those elders who may not be able to get services, and those families are giving money to those elders to help them have their basic needs met. So I really appreciated that was called out in the main report, also the level of Social Security that they would be able to get. And I just wondered if you had any other comments about that. Thank you.
Chair Hassan, Representative, thank you for all of the commentary in terms of older women. Absolutely. We know that Social Security is based upon your wage income. So if it's the individual woman's Social Security, not in the case of when they may get it from a spouse that is deceased, in that case they may actually be better off because they get that advantage. But divorced women or unmarried women or women that depend on their own salary earnings over their lifetime, that Social Security is lower because of all the reasons I've stated, taking time out of the workforce, getting a lower wage over time. Women also, on average, live longer than men. And that also means we have a higher concentration of women in the older ages in our society, leading to that need for care, just as you have said, Representative. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you have a follow-up, Reverend? Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. This was a great information. You just reminded us that we have come a long way, but we still have a lot of work to do. So thank you. Our next item on the agenda is House File 2666. I will move that House File 2666 be re-referred to Ways and Means. Welcome to the committee, Rep. Hollins, Mr. Mayor. Please introduce your bill and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I am very happy to be here today to present House File 2666 to establish a statewide basic income grant program. This program would serve as a demonstration project that unconditional cash payments made directly to families can work in every corner of the state. I first learned about our basic income program that we had piloted in the city of St. Paul that Mayor Carter piloted during the pandemic, and it really struck a chord with me, and I was able to speak with a number of the people who had been a part of that program and learn about how they were able to use that money to in ways that were very creative and unique in my mind, and that really the programs that we have available through state funding don't necessarily get at, because they do have the flexibility to spend that money the way that they need to. I think today's testifiers are going to be from my district in St. Paul, but this bill is supported by a broad coalition of organizers that have either run basic income programs or interested in the economic security of Minnesotans. And you can find those coalition supporters on the one-page handout that should be in your packet. You'll also find in your packet support letters from statewide coalitions like Homes for All, who believe that this can address housing insecurity. I wanted to note that Springboard for the Arts ran a multi-site basic income pilot in the Twin Cities and Otter Tail County and saw impacts on workforce development in Greater Minnesota. So this really is a this is a program that can be used to facilitate better working conditions and job security, as well as economic and job improvement, right? Like, people are able to use that funding to improve their employment. The International Institute ran a basic income program with immigrants and refugees who recently arrived in the country and getting them on their feet and a pathway to better employment, and they had great success with that. And there are many other supporters who believe that this program can uniquely impact Minnesotans with disabilities, Native Americans, and more. So I would like to use most of my time for my testifiers, who are able to better explain the program.
Rep. Holland, Mr. Mayor, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, even though you don't need introduction, and proceed.
Chair Hassan, members of the committee, thank you so much for the invitation to have this important conversation today. My name is Melvin Carter. I serve as mayor of the city of St. Paul and as national co-chair of an organization called Mayors for Guaranteed Income. I want to share with you an idea, a policy concept, that is very relevant to the presentation that you just received this morning. Right now, St. Paul is at the center of a nationwide conversation about how guaranteed income can help raise the income floor for our most vulnerable neighbors and provide them with the opportunity to achieve upward financial mobility. At the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, we leveraged CARES Act dollars to launch our People's Prosperity Guaranteed Income Pilot, the first publicly funded guaranteed income pilot in the nation. The pilot gave 150 low-income families $500 a month for 18 months with no strings attached, and the results were groundbreaking. These unconditional cash payments helped families pay the rent, buy groceries, obtain childcare, and get out of debt. Instead of scraping by month to month, several families were able to put money into savings for the first time. Contrary to the notion that guaranteed income rewards laziness and drains the economy by discouraging work, we learned that those in our pilot program actually gained employment after receiving the monthly payments. Data from our pilot showed that participant employment grew from 49% at the beginning of the pilot to 63% 6 months after the program ended, a 14% increase. That's because the extra $500 a month allowed people to get childcare, buy a new suit for a job interview, take time away from a part-time job to interview for a full-time job, fix that broken tire, address all of the million different things that can be, present as barriers to Minnesotans participating fully in our economy and workforce. Anecdotally, but often an important indicator of sustained success, families reported a decrease in anxiety and depression, favorable levels of health, and increased feelings of hope even 6 months after the pilot ended. This sense of hope and resilience is a mindset we all lean on during challenging times. They're powerful sentiments that help us move forward. Critics of guaranteed income argue the same harmful narrative and disparaging tropes about what low-income people will do with a monthly cash benefit. But the data tells us, from study after study after study around the country — I mentioned that I'm one of the national co-chairs of Mayors for Guaranteed Income after St. Paul became the second city, the first to use public funds, we now have over 60 pilots running around the country, all of which with independent third-party evaluation, which is absolutely critical. So while we all grew up with those harmful narratives about what low-income people will do with a monthly cash benefit or if they have money, the data from study after study after study is showing us that those people spend their money much the same as you and I would, on rent, groceries, clothes for their children, and other daily necessities. Now St. Paul is engaging in another pilot, College Bound Boost, that pairs guaranteed income with asset building via college savings accounts. We're looking forward to seeing the results of that study. Economic insecurity is not new. It's not a partisan issue, and it's certainly not limited to our metropolitan areas in our state. It's a statewide concern that demands statewide solutions. As leaders here in Minnesota, we have the incredible opportunity to change that narrative, to reverse course and break cycles of generational poverty, to start raising the income floor for Minnesotans who need and deserve it, giving them the opportunity to thrive. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as a Minnesotan who is used to poverty and hunger in our communities, as a Minnesotan who is used to our residents sleeping outdoors even when it's 20 below, I am well aware that the policy we're proposing today is a significant departure from what we're all used to. In fact, that's one of my favorite things about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I believe we have two more testifiers, and then we will have a discussion. Casey from City of St. Paul, Financial Capability Manager. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Casey Wiedrich, the Financial Capability Manager from the City of St. Paul's Office of Financial Empowerment. And I manage the city's two guaranteed income programs that Mayor Carter mentioned, which provide 483 St. Paul residents with an unconditional $500 a month for 18 and 24 months, respectively. And I've also provided guidance and technical assistance to almost 10 other basic income programs that have launched or are planning in Minnesota, as well as over a dozen cities across the country. And I thank you for this opportunity to testify on House File 2666. So today I'm going to walk you through the bill, and there's both a bill summary and a one-pager which provides details, so feel free to look at either as we're going through our testimony. So this bill will establish a statewide competitive grant program through the Department of Human Services to provide regular unconditional cash payments to eligible Minnesotans. This competitive grant structure allows for local communities to design their own programs to best meet the needs of their specific communities. Their needs and their goals, you know, be in rural, urban, or tribal settings. So grant applicants must be a local government, tribal government, or a nonprofit organization across Minnesota. And DHS will follow the grant-making policies and procedures outlined in state statutes to protect public funds. Grantees would provide monthly payments to participants of at least $500 for at least 18 months. And eligible recipients include individuals or families with incomes at or below 300% of the federal poverty level, or those receiving other public benefits. But grantees would have the flexibility to design their own programs and set other eligibility requirements. For those who may be concerned about grants made to organizations by the state, I will note that this bill is subject to the pre-award risk assessment under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 16B.97 and .98. Which require the department to evaluate the risk of the grantee, whether that is the capacity to deliver the program or meet compliance requirements of the grant. So this bill also directs DHS to evaluate the program through an independent evaluator and to establish a community practice, which will allow the state not only to understand the efficacy of the program, but to gather lessons on how best to implement flexible supports to different populations in different communities across the state. As I have administered basic income payments over the last 3 years, I've witnessed how they've helped families make ends meet day to day and work towards their long-term goals by taking training to qualify for a better job, as Mayor Carter spoke about, or to save to buy a house, or to experience joy because they have a little bit of money left over that they can buy their children cupcakes for their birthdays that they wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. A statewide income program, a basic income program, will expand these opportunities to thousands more Minnesotans. And I thank you again for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Leandra Estes. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning to you all. My name is Leandra Estes. I am a descendant of the historic Rondo community and now a homeowner in the Frogtown community in St. Paul, Minnesota. I am a mother, a college graduate, an employee, and a community activist advocating for the good of the people. Thank you, Chair Hassan, Representative Hollins, and members of the committee for this opportunity to testify once again on House File 2666 and share my experience with the St. Paul College Boon, College Boost Guaranteed Income Program. It was upon giving birth to my now two-year-old son that I learned about the College Bound Program. And as an advocate for my children and myself, I immediately took interest in learning more about College Bound. I navigated through the simple directions to enroll, and through some short phone communication when I had questions, I was pleasantly introduced to the College Bound Boost, a basic income program that guarantees $500 monthly state payments. I now stand before you as a College Bound Boost parent, advocate, ambassador, and committee chair representative. And wearing these titles is my proud duty to serve as a link, a recruiter, and educator to the program. College Boost has changed my life impressively. It has provided me with the means to save intentionally, and that's something I had not been able to do since becoming a successful homeowner almost 5 years ago. College Boost has provided me an emergency account. In the past days, actually a few weeks, my son came down with influenza B and double ear infections. He also has a long battle with asthma and eczema. For me, this meant doctor appointment, a long drive out to Eagan to see the doctor, and lots of medication. That all transpired to me as money. I need money. I got to get gas. I got to get out to the doctor. I have to get this medication. And I have 3 days before payday. And I'm already tapped out. This program helped me with that link of getting that medication and getting that gas to get to that appointment. College Boost has afforded me the ability to send my daughter to an HBCU college tour. This is an experience of a lifetime and means everything for her future. It also has helped me to pay off my past due child care bills. This past winter, I was able to purchase 4 new tires for our transport needs. And most dear to my heart, College Boost blessed me with the affordability to purchase a large sofa rather than the small love seat we had. This was very important to me, as just 6 months ago, I lost my brother to pancreatic cancer. And throughout his last months of living, him, a family man who endured to spend time with family every opportunity we had to be together, that's what we were together. He's a pillar in the community. But during that time, me being the homeowner of the family, that's where we would be, my home. That having that large sofa was everything for me to be able to fit my large family in our home and to comfortably surround him as he took his last breaths, as he hospiced at home. My brother is a hero to us. See, in 1 year, College Boost aided me with servicing my vehicle, providing care, providing for my children and my family, investing and saving. Imagine what the outcome is going to be another year from now. See, the last time I came and I testified on College Boom, College Boost, I said that it gives us individuals hope. It brings us joy and security, and most of all, it allows us to believe that our dreams will become reality through financial support. But it is my duty to state that College Boost will, with unrestricted flexible funds and flexible spending, help one to build value of self, increasing their self-worthiness, create opportunity, provide, protect, and invest. Again, I thank you, Chair Representative Hollins, and thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Estes, and I'm sorry for your loss. And thank you for sharing your story and reminding us this is about real people and real lives. Thank you. Discussion on the bill. Representative Feist.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you, Representative Hollins, for bringing this proposal to the legislature. Mayor Carter said, like, this is different than what we've attempted, at least at the state level, in the past. And I think it's really important. And I love data. And I love, you know, that there are 60 other studies going on with the, quality research, really looking at the impact. I was mentioning the other night, I'm going to get a little philosophical, but I took a poverty law class, and we did this thing where he drew like a line across the chalkboard and made us all kind of confront, like, what do we think a poor person is entitled to? And so, like, it started out with, like, basic needs, and it went from there to, like, living, like, a full, thriving, joy-filled life. And, you know, talking about cupcakes, like we all deserve to, like, give our children joy, to, like, have things in our lives that give us joy. And I just, I think a lot about the bureaucratic red tape that goes into helping people just get the basic needs. And I love the philosophy underlying this. So thank you so much for bringing it.
Rep. Koslowski.
Thank you, Chair. And Rep. Hollins and Mayor Carter for bringing this proposal forward. As somebody who comes from communities that measures wealth in how much we give away and not how much we hoard, we talk about it, we say madu kadin, which is the equitable distribution of resources, and I think we saw that reflected in the last presentation with the Women's Foundation and how those systems are set up to really box folks out. And coming from a community, I really appreciate the testifier sharing your story that coming from communities that we have the wealth gap, we have an inheritance gap. I tell people that when my mom, and she died in the streets, she didn't have to be this way. I think, like, this kind of a guaranteed income would be life-changing and life-saving and legacy-making instead of life-taking, right? And I think it's really exciting to look at what places across the country, whether it's Los Angeles, St. Paul, as has been evidence, but also in British Columbia, where now they're actually looking at Canada, looking at how do we do this on a larger scale, and even looking at, instead of a monthly income, doing a lump sum. I think they did $7,500, and a lot of the same evidence came out that, you know, it actually creates trust in social institutions. Look at the pandemic at a time when we're able to say economic systems and government systems can work in crisis. So why not all the time? That it reduced crime, that people, in fact, didn't spend, the money on things that we often assume they're spending on. It's daily necessities, as we heard. Last year, we passed as a legislature the first ever cash income pilot for homeless youth, and many of those are BIPOC and queer youth, and that is now underway in Hennepin County, in St. Louis County, and White Earth Nation, and creating the roadmap to not just how do we know what causes poverty, we know what causes homelessness, but how do we flip it on its head on a strength base and start looking at how do we create that roadmap based off of those strengths and on that goodness. And so I'm excited to support and see this go forward, and so that we can start to create that roadmap out of and creating those systems of care. So thank you so much for bringing this forward.
Rep. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins, and the testifiers for your clarity in talking about the importance of this program. I really like this program. I'm on the bill. Just to add to the discussion, what I love about this bill is I think it gets down to a couple of, like, societal lies that we're taught to believe, right? One of them is that there is not enough prosperity to go around, that we must fight against each other, that we have to claw to make sure that ours and our family are okay. But we as a state create a lot of wealth. We create a lot of prosperity. And it's through our daily lives. Yes, our labor, but also our going to the grocery store and our taking care of our kids and our watching movies and our going to amusement parks or buying cupcakes. This creates all this. And we together can decide that we can create a society where that prosperity is shared and where people don't have to decide between feeding their children and feeding themselves. or having a love seat or having a couch. Our society, we don't have to have that, and I think this is a great tool to do this. I also think the other lie that we're taught to believe is that only when we are creating wealth, and usually wealth for other people, is our labor worthy of pay. And again, if we think about that for a minute, we know that's not true. Because of our parents, because of our teachers, because of our friends, because of our children. And this is another tool to say it is not just 9 to 5 that is important in an economic sense. It is all of somebody's life. And so this is something new, but I think it is a new way of making manifest, I think, the morals that we all have deep down within us. So again, thank you, Representative Hollins. Thank you, testifiers. And I hope that this is something that Minnesota can continue to lead on.
Thank you. Rep. Igo.
Thing, Madam Chair, I want to dig into the language of the bill a little bit. So lines 3.1 through 3.3 goes over some of the eligibility requirements. It lists in there, you know, it cannot require proof of residency, citizenship, or identifying documentation. And I guess I'm just familiar, or I just want to know why that's in there. Or, and maybe if the mayor's okay too, asking if do you guys use the same for City of St. Paul in your programs, do you not require that stuff?
Mr. Mayor.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. I probably have to ask Casey to be more clear about some of the specific eligibility criteria with regard to our St. Paul pilots. I will say, with regard to our St. Paul pilots and many of the things that we do, our focus is always on access to ensure that all of our residents can participate, not just in the basic quality of life supports that we provide in our community. As a city, we're responsible for sending fire trucks when there's a fire, ambulances when someone is in a health emergency, police officers when there's a crime being committed, and we are very well versed in how we are all enmeshed in that web of mutuality. And so our focus is always on making sure that all of our residents can access the highest quality of life. I'll ask Casey maybe to speak more specifically.
We'll maybe pull up another chair too, so we can all be here. But thank you, Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. So in our first pilot in St. Paul, we did not require documentation. We did. We had one-on-one appointments with everyone who was enrolling in the program, and we collected information on benefits that they might receive and asked them questions about their income. We did not require additional income in our second pilot. We did, because of our funding source, require documentation, but again, it was a one-on-one appointment is the primary way that we are enrolling everyone. So everyone, we met with them either over a Zoom in person or in person, depending on sort of what worked for the participant, and collected minimal documentation to verify their eligibility.
Igo, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So the reason I asked that, and thank you, Mr. Mayor, because you kind of said the point that I'm trying to reach at. You said you want to take care of your residents. And when we're using the term public funds, that's taxpayer dollars. So when I see lines in bills like this saying that we're not going to ask for any proof of residency or citizenship or identifying documentation, I think that opens the door to a lot of fraud. And I'm trying to look at your bill objectively and say we're trying to help people, but let's make sure we're actually going to help people and we're not going to be shipping dollars out in fraudulent cases. And, unfortunately, Minnesota has history of this right now. We have some issues we need to go through. So I think we need to be really careful that we don't open the door for another Feeding Our Future scandal by making sure we don't have any guardrails on stuff like this. So I'm just really concerned about it. So I want to just kind of dive into that. I think that's a major concern in the bill. But I would like to ask for a roll call on this bill.
A roll call has been requested. A roll call it will be granted.
Thank you.
Representative Katisa Watun.
Madam Chair, can you remind me of the motion?
The motion,
relaying the bill over.
No, we're not. Okay. We're sending the bill to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that reminder. So just secondarily, this is the third time that I've heard this bill. I actually joked with Representative Hollins if she was only trying to come to the committees that I sit on.
Maybe she likes you.
I like her too. And I like this bill. I like this proposal. I think that it is worth giving a little bit of background. So when I first heard about universal basic income, I had attended a presentation, continuing education credit situation at the University of St. Thomas Law School. And it was, you know, they were talking about this and how reaching out to people on the margins of life is a Catholic principle. It's a faith-based principle. And I don't often talk about my faith in this role. But I think that it's important to recognize the humanity in people simply because they are fellow human beings, not because they were born here, not because they have a fancy job, not because they went to a certain college, not because of their skin color. And my first job out of college actually was, I was a migrant recruiter in a very rural school district in Northeast Wisconsin. And so I was working, part of my position was paid for by the local school district. I was a ELL aide and the only person who spoke Spanish in the K-8 school building, which was a really interesting experience in itself, working with Latino migrants. But I also was working for the State Department of Education. And part of my role was to go to the migrant residency where they had basically shacks to house these migrant workers to work at the vegetable cannery in town. And they were there for the harvest season. I think it's really important to note, and when we talk about documentation, oftentimes these workers, these parents, would disrupt the stability of their family to come to where they knew work and income could be found for this season. And then they would take their kids back to wherever the work could be found. And I want to make it clear that regardless of whether someone is a documented citizen of the United States of America, that does not take away from their humanity, and it does not take away from how hard they work and how much they care about their kids and how much they contribute to our economy. That's right. Because they do pay taxes and they do contribute. And we need to see people as people. And it was not required of me to ask for their documentation for their children to be able to attend school while their parents worked for that season and contributed to the economy of Wisconsin and to the United States of America. Thank you for bringing this forward. It's worthy of conversation. I'm not saying that this is the year to move on it, but I appreciate you educating us on what the possibilities are.
Thank you, Rep. Katis Wutun. Thank you, Mr. Mayor and the St. Paul folks for coming. You guys know Minneapolis and St. Paul are always fighting over who's the best, but today I take my hat off for you guys and say St. Paul is leading the way. Thank you. What I love about this bill, it's centered on humanity. Mm. I am, by training, I'm a social worker, and social work, we have a theory that talks about people-centered solutions. So this is a person-centered solution. We're meeting people where they're at. There was a hearing this morning at Workforce where a young man who was testifying was talking about a story. He told us a story, and the story was, he said, two young people fell in a hole, and they stayed in that hole, and everybody walks by and is just laughing at them, saying that, why the heck are they in this hole? And a man and a woman jump in the hall with them. And the two young people said, what are you guys doing? Why did you jump in the hall with us? They said, we created this hall. We're the ones that created this hall. We know what it feels like to be in this hall. So we're going to be here with you. So the reason why I'm sharing that story is we as a society created the disparities. We created systems that are unequal for people. We created the wealth gap. We created every problem that exists. So being part of the solution is the least we can do. So thank you, Lead Kosnick.
Yeah, sorry, Madam Chair. I thought I was on the list. I didn't mean to go after your comments. But just wanted to maybe ask the author on line 4.2 and 4.6. In section 2, it talks about the appropriation of the bill. $100 million. $100 million in fiscal year 2025 is appropriated from the general fund, and then also $3 million ongoing to administer the program. I presume that the author and the committee understands that that's scalable. At what point is it, how scalable is it in your mind?
Reb Hollins.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lead Kosnick. So one thing I will say is this is a one-time appropriation, so it's not ongoing. we think that this program is very scalable, and by evidence, right, St. Paul has a program, Minneapolis has a program, different places have done different things. We recognize that $100 million in a non-budget year is a steep request. We're not ignorant of that fact, but we thought it was really important to get this conversation started and to, and I think to that point, going through two other committee hearings, we've gotten a lot of constructive feedback on ways to tighten the language and to address some of the concerns that folks have that we're taking very seriously and we're looking at. In my mind, this can be scaled. We have talked about scaling it to as low as $5 million. And certainly I have heard other smaller other communities looking at, if we looked at a particular municipality or county or you know, Native community, that it could be scaled as low as $1 million. That being said, of course, we're going to continue pushing for larger amounts of money. But I think that the possibility of scaling is clearly very possible. It just depends on, you know, what the political will is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Representative Hollins, I appreciate that you didn't just put the dot, dot, dots in there that we see on some bills, that just the open appropriation. We'll take as much money as we can get. The taxpayers of the state of Minnesota, you know, are cognizant of the fact that we blew through a $20 billion surplus, that we were taxed an additional $10 million last year that's going to start kicking in. And then we're possibly facing a deficit in ongoing years. And so I give you credit for being, you know, standing behind your proposal. $100 million is a huge amount of money, that, recognizing that it's scalable, but, you know, we know what the, you know, good luck in the Ways and Means Committee here, but you know, the cost is just, you know, astronomical here, in addition to just the concept, having some contention with other benefits that the state generously provides, and then the ongoing $3 million cost just to administer the program should cause a lot of concern. But, I'll just leave it at that without getting into too much other concerns with the bill. But just the cost alone should be a concern. And I appreciate the roll call, and I recommend a no vote.
Thank you. I'll come back to you, Chair Shong. Rep. Wiener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry for going out of order. I thought I got your attention before, but I apologize. There is a misconception that's gone on quite a bit here today. Universal basic income is not a new idea, not by any means. It's been practiced. It's been done since the late 60s all over the country. Different forms, different methods. And I do appreciate, you know, disparities. I come from the poorest area in the state. Really, our counties have statistically been the poorest areas of the state, and we look for economic growth to bring us there, to bring us out of that. But with the universal economic, or this bill, which has been tried before, it always run into the same obstacle, and that's you run out of somebody else's money to spend. I believe there's better ways to deal with this, with these low-income issues. And I thank you for your testifying, because this hits our area, you know. But when we are going to take tax money from other areas of the state that are already struggling, we've talked about prosperity in this committee. It's been brought up many times. If we have prosperity, then we shouldn't necessarily have that distribution of wealth issue. But we do, and we probably always will. How do we change that? By taking money from one to give it to another is not the best answer. I think if we build up an economy that serves communities and districts better, we can solve some of these problems. I don't necessarily, it has not worked in the 60, 70 years that it's been tried. And if it has worked, then we should have examples of it where we're not testing and piloting new programs. So I think, there again, we've talked about in the state being spending a $20 billion surplus, raising $10 billion in taxes, looking at a financial or fiscal deficit, and here we're looking at spending another $100 million that would probably have a negative impact on my area by taking more taxpayer dollars out of their pockets when they're already struggling. This doesn't make sense to me. I think there's better methods, better options than this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Chair Sean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Mayor, and Representative Hollins for bringing this bill. I'm for support of it. I really appreciate the work that you've done for our city. And I just want to address this notion that somehow this bill was going to be an open for undocumented people and that it's going to be wasting tax dollar bills. Well, you know, last I checked, fraud knows no boundaries. It is not limited to undocumented people. And last I checked, that guy running for president on a Republican ticket also is committing fraud. So next time when you want to start addressing fraud, please take a look at your own party. Thank you.
Thank you. Final words on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, for the discussion. I appreciate it. Representative Weiner, I appreciate you bringing up Greater Minnesota, because that was sort of the goal with this program, right? Doing a statewide pilot program, because the city of St. Paul has already done one. Minneapolis is currently doing one. We want to bring what we're doing to the rest of Minnesota, because it's true, right? There is poverty across the state of Minnesota, and they are disproportionately impacted by it. And I will roughly misquote Chair Lislegarde that the Twin Cities disproportionately creates wealth in tax base because of the density of the population, but we send a lot of that money other places in the state of Minnesota, and this is exactly what we want to do with this program, is sending that money to other places in Minnesota and trying to help lift those individuals out of poverty as well. The one thing I will note is that there is a statewide UBI program. The only other one is in the state of Alaska. As you might know, there are people who get a monthly or yearly amount of money. And the poverty rates in Alaska are significantly lower than in the state of Minnesota, and that is partially due to that. So depending on how you look at it, I would say that there is some evidence of success for universal basic income. In my final thoughts, I just want to say we have a lot of programs that are administered by the state or by counties or by municipalities for a lot of different reasons. But what I'm really struck by when I talk to people who have been recipients of universal basic income is how all of those programs don't necessarily get at the things that they need when they need it. You don't know that you're going to need medicine for your sick child until it happens. You don't know that your tires are going to go out and you're going to have to get your tires replaced until that happens. You don't know that you're going to need to take time off from your hourly job to go interview for a better job until that opportunity presents itself. And UBI is flexible spending that allows people to address those needs when they have them and make sure that they're able to pivot in the way they need to help raise them out of poverty. This isn't something that we're looking at as a permanent fix. This is something that we are looking at as a way to help lift people up in their time of need and then hopefully put them in a better place so that they are earning more, so that they are contributing to local businesses and local economies in a way that is beneficial for all Minnesotans. So I appreciate the conversation today, and I would encourage a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Collins. I renew my motion that House File 2666 be referred to Ways and Means. We'll take the roll.
Chair Hassan?
Aye.
Hassan? Aye. Vice Chair Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen? Aye. Lead Cosnett?
No.
Cosnett? No. Rep. Feist?
Aye.
Rep. Feist? Aye. Rep. Igo? No. Rep. Igo? No. Rep. Katiza Watun?
Aye.
Rep. Katiza Watun? Aye. Rep. Kozlowski?
Aye.
Rep. Kozlowski? Aye. Rep. Perryman?
No.
Rep. Perryman? No. Rep. Ryer?
Aye.
Rep. Ryer? Aye. Rep. Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Rep. Schumacher? No. Rep. Smith?
Aye.
Rep. Smith?
Aye.
Rep. Weiner?
No.
Rep. Weiner? No. Rep. Zhang?
Aye.
Rep. Zhang?
Aye.
With that, the roll is closed.
Thank you. With 8 ayes and 5 nays, the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So we have 2 bills and 15 minutes. We're going to take off one of the bills of the – we have 3 bills, actually. So we'll take House File 4303 off the agenda and hear it the next time we're together. So I'm going to be very on edge, so people just keep your testimonies short. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 5143. Rep. Nelson, welcome to the committee. I'll move that House File 5143. This is informational based only. Yes. Okay, so we're not sending it anywhere. All right. I'll move it in front of the committee. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. House File 5143. It's a bill that would grant a special development authority to the city of Brooklyn Park for development of a biotech innovation district. It would also allocate money from existing appropriations and appropriate new monies to Brooklyn Park, including from the housing and infrastructure money, a Drive for Five grant, a water infrastructure grant, workforce development funding, and funding for the city's small business center, and a grant for the Minnesota Investment Fund. And, Madam Chair, I have the mayor of Brooklyn Park here with me, and we have the city manager here to explain the bill.
Okay. All right.
I think you have a presentation, too.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Mayor. Please introduce yourself. Like I said, we have 2 bills and 15 minutes on the clock. So I'll give you more time, but the other testifier is 2 minutes. So. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed, Mr. Mayor.
All right, so Madam Chair and House members, I very much appreciate, my name is Hollis Winston, Mayor of the City of Brooklyn Park. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I know that there was some banter about there being a competition between Brooklyn Park and Minneapolis being, well, not Brooklyn Park, Minneapolis and St. Paul being the best cities. Brooklyn Park has also entered the chat. So I want to again thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah.
So just a little bit about the city of Brooklyn Park. I believe we're the 5th largest. A lot of people say 6th largest. We're not going to get into details on this, but we are one of the most diverse cities out there with a BIPOC population of about 60%. There's also a ton of economic diversity within our city as well, and a ton of our residents are actually born outside of this of the city. But one of the things we know about Brooklyn Park is that people move out there not just for the culture, the diversity, but they also move out there for the opportunities to start anew, to grow their family. And so they're investing in themselves, they're investing in businesses, and increasingly they're trying to invest in their neighborhoods to bring it up. But what we are not seeing is corresponding support from the state. And we have not seen that for a number of decades. So if we take a look, we'll go back. Yeah. Okay. If we take a look at the LGA per capita on that x-axis, right, that's that net tax capacity, Brooklyn Park is very low on that. But then if you look on the Y, we are not receiving much LGA, if at all. And so we're not able to generate the capacity, but the investment has not been there compared to other similarly sized cities. If we take a look very quickly at a city that's a few thousand larger than us, their commercial property values are about $5.5 billion. Ours are $2 billion. That's a $3.5 billion gap. So when you look at our public safety, it's 55% to 60%. That's not because we're overspending. It's not because of the crime issue. It's because we don't necessarily have the budget to do that. That cuts into what we can do for youth. That cuts into what we can do for basic operations and maintenance. And then that tax burden falls to the residents and the small businesses. And it's increasingly become an unbearable burden. So I think we as a city believe we have a solution to this. So when you look at Brooklyn Park, and I want to thank the folks who came here to support us as well. So Greater MSP, we're partnering with their efforts, Medical Alley, some of our partners and laborers as well as the Black Chamber. We're increasingly saying there's MedTech 3.0 for the state of Minnesota. We know that for Minnesota to stay relevant and to guarantee the quality of life that has been guaranteeing for quite some time, Minnesota's going to have to win with MedTech 3.0. That's the strategy that the state's going to continue to go forward with. But we're also in the second round of a federal grant, and Minnesota, I mean, Brooklyn Park is helping to partner with Greater MSP on that and some other partners in that. Brooklyn Park has some strengths to bring to this. We have 700 acres of undeveloped land, 250 of that we're setting aside for a biotech innovation district. But we've also done the work of investing in our workforce. So when we talk about programs like Brooklink that invest in youth and connect them to businesses, local businesses, manufacturing, larger businesses, we've been doing that for quite some time. There is some other legislation where we have around TIF and value capture. We have skin in this game, and then we have a small business center, which we were able to cobble together with federal resources, county-level resources, and then Brooklyn Park acquired some property to have some affordable spaces for businesses to begin. So when we talk about that biotech innovation and what that looks like to dovetail into that MedTech 3.0, if you look along the 610 corridor north of that, and then you look 169 on either side, there is a medical alley that already exists with between Maple Grove and Brooklyn Park and going a little bit further. Takeda, Boston Scientific, Medtronic, they have places in there. Brooklyn Park is very much a part of that, and we're saying we need to grow that for the economic opportunities for our community. But also when you look at either beefed up bus service along that route or light rail, whichever one it becomes, right, we will have the capacity to get people north, south, east, west for these businesses to serve these businesses. But if you really want to see what we're talking about, right, 700 acres is a lot of land. This is a small portion of that. When we think of this, we think of 8,000 to 10,000 jobs. Medical Alley has looked into this a little bit, and they're saying it could be potential 8,000 or 10,000 jobs within this particular corridor, and the wealth that creates for communities is incredibly important, as well as the tax revenue for our city so that we can do the basic services that we need to do. Yeah, to the next one. So, but there are some critical investments that would come with that, and many of the appropriations that we've requested in here are going back to former years, appropriations that occurred from that, so we're not asking for necessarily new dollars. But water infrastructure to build this out for the businesses and for the workforce housing that we're going to need to have there, be about $12 million to develop quality housing. We know we have a housing shortage throughout the state. It exists where we live as well. So $10 million. $3.5 million for that Brooklink. So one of the things we've heard from companies is that if we're going to place our businesses there, is the workforce going to be prepared for that? And we want to continue to beef up Brooklink, which is something that has helped hundreds of youth get those jobs. And then lastly, finding a way to create and attract those businesses. So yes, we have a small business center, but as those businesses come, we want to help those businesses grow to serve those biotech businesses, to serve new businesses there, and the housing that's there as well. So just to close this out, because I know short on time on this, I want to say that I would ask people do not look at this just as an investment in Brooklyn Park. And Brooklyn Park is incredibly important to me. But also we're dovetailing into something that at the state level we're looking for, which is MedTech 3.0. And I also want to say this. I've heard a ton of talk about disparities today. Disparities exist very much in our city if you're talking about 60% people of color. If you grow those jobs and you grow those economic opportunities, you will not only impact the disparities that exist in Brooklyn Park, but you will be impacting disparities at a statewide level, and you will actually make an impact in numbers that we have not really seen change for decades. So it hits a number of objectives. And again, I want to thank everybody for the opportunity to come before you and speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Up next, we have Ben Wagner from Medical Alley. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of this committee. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Ben Wagner. I'm here today with Medical Alley. Medical Alley represents a global network of more than 800 leading health technology and care companies from all corners of the state of Minnesota. With access, affordability, and quality as top priorities, Medical Alley and our partners are committed to developing solutions which drive meaningful change and save lives. It is with these guiding principles that we extend our support for House File 5143, establishing this biotech innovation district in the city of Brooklyn Park. Progress in the biotechnology industry has the potential to improve lives in ways we've only begun to imagine. From revolutionizing healthcare through personalized medicine and cutting-edge treatments, to addressing global challenges such as food security, environmental sustainability, and disease prevention, biotech stands at the forefront of innovation. Brooklyn Park and the state of Minnesota have a unique opportunity to position this region as a leader in this growing market, which may triple in size in the next 10 years. The city is already home, as Mayor Winston mentioned, to some of Medical Alley's leading partners in technology and manufacturing, including Medtronic, Steris, CVRX, and more. This district could catalyze further investment along the Highway 610 corridor and beyond. Finally, Brooklyn Park is home to nearly 90,000 residents, more than 60% of which identify as Black, Indigenous, or a person of color. The city is Minnesota's sixth largest, or maybe fifth, and one of the most diverse. The establishment of a biotech innovation district would create as many as 10,000 quality and sustainable jobs to the benefit of residents in the city and those surrounding it, many of which currently face disparities in health, income, and public safety. We must do more to ensure that equal opportunities and access to these emerging industries is equal, and this proposal does just that. This project doesn't benefit just one city or even one region. That we believe this district will make the Northwest Metro an international destination for biotech manufacturing and position Minnesota for an equitable future. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Kim Nelson from North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Hassan, members of the committee, my name is Kim Nelson. I'm Assistant Political Director at the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. We represent 27,000 construction workers in the upper Midwest. Over 13,000 of those are here in Minnesota, and quite a few hundred live right in Brooklyn Park in the surrounding area. I'm here today to speak in support of the Biotech Innovation District. My daily job, 80% of my time is spent working with the suburban municipalities in the metro area here. And we've had a strong working relationship with Brooklyn Park on addressing just a number of key issues that are of concern to us. And so we have no doubt that they are problem solvers and that they are, it's a great city to invest in. We have over 700 acres of developable land there. They're on a major transportation corridor. And more than that, more than anything, they have a great city council and they have fantastic people that live in the surrounding area. We're here ready to work with them to bring local folks into our registered apprenticeship programs. Earlier you spoke about the gender wage gap as well as wanting to build strength through economic development. This is that project, right? So we want to work with the city of Brooklyn Park to make sure that as we build not only the biotech facilities and the housing around it, that we are bringing in more apprentices that are women, Black, Indigenous people of color from Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, and the surrounding areas. We've already started that work, and we look forward to continuing that work. We ask for your support.
Thank you. Our last testifier, Eliza Darris, Policy Chair, Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Darris, introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and honorable members of the committee. My name is Eliza Darris, and I serve as the policy chair for the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce. I come before you to advocate for a project that stands as a landmark of opportunity for Brooklyn Park and Minnesota at large. The Brooklyn Park Biotech Innovation District. This district is more than infrastructure. It is a commitment to the human potential of our region. It promises 10,000 new jobs and 3,000 housing units, directly addressing the workforce disparities that impact our communities. In alignment with the values of the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce, we endorse projects that foster equitable and inclusive economic growth. The Biotech Innovation District represents an investment that enables underrepresented communities to partake in the economic mainstream, particularly in the burgeoning field of biotechnology. Brooklyn Park is poised for this transformation. As the Northwest suburbs grow, and Minneapolis and other areas are finding that their residents are relocating, Brooklyn Park emerges as a natural hub for this growth, demanding our attention and also our investment. By supporting this legislation, we affirm a vision for growth that is equitable, creating a framework for prosperity that is shared across all demographics, and setting a precedent for economic development that is inclusive by design. I urge you to support House File 5143 and join us in this commitment to build a prosperous and equitable future that all of our members will be able to enjoy. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I want to be respectful of people's time. I know that we're going to go over time, but also Rep. Igo has a bill, and his folks came from Greater Minnesota, so I hope everyone is okay a little, maybe 10 or 15 minutes after 12. Discussion on the bill. Lead Kasnick.
Madam Chair, I'll just briefly say I appreciate hearing the bill. I think it's a worthy initiative. Figure out the details, but you know, I also want to thank Representative Nelson for working on committees with him, not this session, but it's good to see you in a committee, and I wish you the best in your future retirement.
Thank you.
Any other comments? All right, final word on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, this is a way Brooklyn Park has a few pieces of a parcel of the land left to develop. This is along, like they said, a major corridor, two major transportation corridors. It'll be, there's already some of this development there. Increasing this development will help increase jobs in the area. It'll help our residents of Brooklyn Park to get good paying jobs, and this is what this bill does.
Thank you to the testifiers, and thank you, Rep. Nelson, for presenting the bill today. Our next and final item on the agenda is House File 5117. I believe this is also an informational hearing only. Rep. Igo, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the extra time to the whole committee. I really appreciate it. So the bill in front of us today is 5117, and it's an appropriation from the Workforce Development Fund for $10 million to the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency. And I'm really excited that I have two testifiers here with me today to tell you about what they do, because I think you're all going to be blown away by how much good work this organization does. A lot of things we talk about in Economic Development Committee are how can we help lift people up, give that hand up, right? That's what AEOA has been doing for almost 60 years. So they're coming to us today as a state asking for help to build a new service center in partnership with the city of Hemming and every single county and region that they impact. So with that, I'll hand it off to them to talk about it, because it's really exciting. So thank you for the time today.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Emily Simonson, and I'm the Director of Planning at Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency, commonly known as AEOA. AEOA is a community action agency committed to providing self-sufficiency services to low-income and disadvantaged individuals across northeastern and central Minnesota for over 59 years. Our mission is to strengthen communities by providing opportunities for people experiencing social and economic challenges. Last year, our agency served more than 38,000 individuals. Over the years, AEOA has expanded its services in response to community needs and currently operates through six service departments in 12 counties in northern Minnesota, which is about one-third of the state. Senior and Nutrition Services supports our aging adults by providing over 300,000 meals annually and provides home modifications for those seeking to age in place. In 2023, this department enabled 10,360 seniors to maintain safe and independent living situations. Our employment and training programs assist community members get their high school diplomas or GEDs, find employment, and train our youth through programs like Youth Build. Arrowhead Head Start guides approximately 400 children and their families annually, setting them on a positive path for the future. Our Arrowhead Transit Department serves 10 counties, which has about 130 buses operating daily, ensuring individuals have reliable transportation for work, medical appointments, and grocery shopping. Last year, they provided over 307,000 rides. Our housing resource team helps unhoused individuals find shelter and work towards permanent housing and self-sufficiency. Additionally, they also offer first-time home buyer classes and counseling. Within our housing service department, a variety of rehabilitation programs are available to assist dozens of families each year in making their homes safe, decent, and affordable. This department includes our weatherization program, which benefits over 200 families annually by improving energy efficiency, and our energy assistance program provides support to over 9,000 families yearly with their utility bills. Our senior nutrition department has an opportunity to extend their meal service to individuals aged 18 through 60 and their dependents experiencing food insecurity. They also hope to expand their production of meals for seniors to over 500,000 meals a year. Our programs continue to grow, which is important to secure adequate space that we don't risk losing as we currently rent all of our facilities. As a community action agency, we uphold the community action promise, which is community action changes people's lives, embodies the spirit of hope, improves communities, and makes America a better place to live. We care about the entire community and are dedicated to helping people help themselves and each other. And together we can continue to make a difference in these communities and remain true to this promise. So thank you for your time today and hearing this bill, a critical need that will continue to allow us to meet the needs for low-income Minnesotans.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Scott. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for affording us the time to come before you today and present our proposal. My name is Scott Zahorek, and I'm lucky enough to be the executive director of the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency in Virginia, Minnesota. And we are a community action. We serve Northeast Minnesota. The motto of community action is helping people changing lives, and we're hoping that you'll help us to do so today. We come before you to ask for your help and support in making life better for economically disadvantaged people in Northeast Minnesota. As Emily stated, we're a community action agency. Our legislative service area covers St. Louis, Lake, and Cook counties, a little over 13,000 square miles, 15% of the state. We've had 9 other counties over the years ask us to provide services in each of their counties, and we've done so, and it brings those 12 counties bring our service area to a little over 26,000 square miles. We cover 30% of the state. So this project is to construct a 36,000 square foot building, staff it, train the staff, purchase the vehicles, tools, and equipment needed. And it's anticipated to cost $16 million. AUA is committed to a $5 million investment in the staffing, vehicles, and other costs. Our ask of the legislature is for a one-time $10 million request for the construction of the building and the other construction-related costs. We'll use some other funds to cover the balance of the building costs. So part of this is our housing and senior services departments that Emily talked about have some opportunities in front of them, and they're poised and ready to go on these. But the problem is that we currently operate out of rented facilities that where our leases could be terminated at any time. They're not affordable to the programs, and we don't have the space that we need to take on this expansion. This proposed facility can make all the difference for the families that are hoping to benefit from these services. Our senior services program currently serves over 300,000 meals per year, and we now have the opportunity to serve over 500,000 meals a year. The housing programs can increase their programs by 30%. But to do this, we need your help. We're not asking the legislature to fund the entire cost. We plan to reach out to the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation, and we've reached out to the 6 counties that will be served by these programs. We did also hear very quickly from the other counties, and so far we've got an ask out there of almost $3 million there, and we've got 1.3 in commitments already that came back almost immediately. And we do expect the other counties to be kicking in their share as well. So now we have those opportunities. Some of the things in housing, we're starting a pilot plan that's going to have St. Louis County convey tax forfeited homes to the city that they're in. They'll convey those homes to AEOA. We'll rehabilitate the homes, and we're going to sell them as affordable workforce housing. It'll put the homes back on the tax rolls. It'll put the kids back in the schools, so there's a lot of other benefits. The first 5 homes have been picked out already, and construction's going to begin on those homes this summer. And then we believe that this program can play a huge part in the housing situation, because not only can we do this in St. Louis County, but we've already had some of the other counties we serve jump on and say their counties are next. We're working with the City of Hibbing to create a housing trust fund. We're working with St. Louis County and the local HRAs to create a rental rehabilitation program. And we're also working on an energy efficiency program for homeowners. So that's a bit about the need. So this request isn't about which side of the aisle we consider ourselves from or whether we live in metro or outstate, but if we'll choose to make life better for those less fortunate than ourselves. We would ask that you please support this request to help change lives for folks in Minnesota for the better, and this investment would change lives for the next 50 years. And thank you. We'd like to thank you and would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much, and thank you for driving all the way down here to come and share the stories of your communities. That's very powerful. Discussion on the bill, Rep. Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Igo, for bringing this forward, and also thanks for coming down and speaking with us. I have just a quick question, whether you also have a bill, a bonding bill with capital investment for the design and construction of the facility. Thanks.
Rep. Igo.
No, there is no bonding request in for this, just because it's being a nonprofit organization, there would have to be a fiscal agent to move forward with any sort of bonding request. So that's why we're moving forward this way. Mm-hmm.
Rep. Ryer.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Of course, there is often a cash option available through bonding, so I just encourage you to think about having dual tracks for a bill like this. Thanks.
Rep. Igo.
Appreciate the advice. I'll look into it. I just, knowing where the state's at this year, I didn't know how big of a cash bill there would be, so this was a place I knew that there would be, we could go for it. Thank you.
Any other discussion on the bill? All right. Last word on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think my testifiers said it best, right? I mean, they really do cover and do everything and are finding unique ways to lift up rural communities across northern Minnesota. Not just northern Minnesota. It's 30% of our state. You know, almost 400,000 meals to people, 316 homes were weatherized, 75 families were helped with energy assistance, 567 homeowners saw conservation improvements, and many more things, helping to keep seniors in their homes. This is a group that's finding very unique ways to make sure and impact our communities and do the right thing. So I appreciate the time today to share their story and hope we can have some consideration to find them some help to get this new service center built. So thank you.
Thank you, testifiers, and thank you, Rep. Igo, for presenting the bill today. With that, I want to thank the committee for the extension of 11 minutes. I guess we had a lot of great bills, and everybody, you know, was so passionate to contribute to those bills. I want to note that next week we don't have a meeting, so we'll meet in 2 weeks with no other business in front of committee. We are adjourned.